From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, as the LA Phil celebrates its centennial, two music critics examine the orchestra's past, present, and future. Then Sandy Tan and her teenage friends made a movie called Shirkers, but the director vanished with the footage. Now, decades later, the movie materialized.
I think of it as like kind of like that Stephen King story, It. I mean, we were children all bound by this kind of dark boogeyman, I guess. And then this thing reappears in our life.
And a photo project documenting Asians who identify as mixed race gets one last exhibit. All that coming up on The Frame. The Los Angeles Philharmonic began making music in 1919, and the orchestra recently launched its ambitious and celebratory 100th anniversary season. In the Phil's modern history, there have been three pivotal music directors: Zubin Mehta, who was appointed in 1962, Esa-Pekka Salonen, who began his tenure in 1992, and, of course, Gustavo Dudamel, who succeeded Salonen in 2009 and still holds the baton. To examine the orchestra on its centennial, we invited two prominent music critics to our studio: Mark Swed, who's been with the LA Times since 1996, and Alex Ross, the bicoastal music critic for The New Yorker. Ross began with how the LA Phil is a bit of a late bloomer compared to other major American symphony orchestras.
There was this great wave of orchestras launched in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, and it was the East Coast and the industrial Midwest. And that's sort of always been the core of the American orchestral world. Boston was really the model when it started for the American orchestra moving on to an international level and really defining a city's whole music culture through its work. But yeah, perpetuating those traditions is often very tricky as the fortunes of cities rise and fall. And then, of course, there are places like LA, whose orchestra has developed more slowly over time and has really come into its own.
Mark, you've had a front row seat to the evolution and growth of the LA Phil for a number of years. I want to ask you about when you started at the LA Times. What was the Phil doing right? What was it doing wrong? What was the state of the orchestra back then?
State of the orchestra was very good, but a little troubled. Esa-Pekka Salonen had been music director for 4 years and was doing really interesting things. He did not have a huge amount of support at the time. Certainly not from the patrons, who thought he was far too avant-garde. There had been the earthquake, the riots, the recession, all of that had hurt the orchestra. Walt Disney Concert Hall was considered moribund at that point. It wasn't going to happen. So there was a huge amount of potential, and there were some really, really interesting things going on. But it was a tricky moment.
Alex, you started writing at the New York Times in 92, which is when Esa-Pekka came to the LA Phil. Do you remember his arrival and what it meant? And if you remember that tough transition that Mark is referring to?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I had really grown to admire him listening mostly on recordings. And he was articulating an idea then which was very important and I think quite visionary for that period. He was saying classical music needs to be on the menu of what especially younger people care about, this cultural menu. And he was saying they're not keeping track of what's going on in classical music, new music, or the older repertory. And so he wanted to move the orchestra into that field. That was his ambition. And he did it. I mean, it took quite a long time, but eventually he achieved exactly that. And that is the tradition at the LA Phil, which remains.
I'm going to play three clips in a row. They're all from Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. The first is conducted by Zubin Mehta. The next is by Esa-Pekka Salonen. And the last is by Gustavo Dudamel. Mark, how would you describe what Mehta and Salonen and Dudamel brought to the orchestra? How would you begin to discuss the differences in their personalities musically?
What they have in common is that all three of them came here very young. Yep. And they all first conducted this orchestra when they were really young. I mean, I think all of them were at least.
As guest conductors, yeah.
As guest conductors. And from the moment they conducted, they became regulars. And really developed through this orchestra and through this place. And if you're going to be playing Rite of Spring, of course, you also have to realize that Stravinsky is to the LA Phil what Mozart is to the Vienna Philharmonic. What Dudamel, Solonen, and Maida all had in common, particularly with Rite of Spring, is how well they do this piece. I believe that Maida was the first to ever conduct it without a score. Dudamel conducted without a score the first time he ever conducted the piece. And Solonen always has a score, but he's probably conducted that piece more than anybody else alive right now. And it is so in his blood. All three of them have an incredible sense of rhythm.
So, Alex, what do you think about their personality? How did they affect the playing of the orchestra?
Well, I think the stereotype would be that Solonen is cooler and more controlled in his approach. Dudamel is more prone to the large gesture. One thing that they both do supremely well is new music and responding to a wide variety of styles in new music with expertise and with enthusiasm. And I think that's one thing that has really defined the LA Phil is, of course, its approach to new music, and it plays more new music than basically any orchestra you can think of. But it also is committed to these works. It does not play them out of a sense of duty, and it does not give you a kind of one portion of the spectrum of what's going on in new music.
That was music critics Alex Ross of The New Yorker and Mark Swed of The LA Times. We'll hear more from them about the LA Philharmonic on tomorrow's show. Coming up, how an unfinished movie filmed in Singapore in 1992 became an urban legend. In 1992, a 19-year-old aspiring filmmaker named Sandy Tan made a movie in Singapore. It was called Shirkers.
A word which means running away, avoiding responsibility, escape. I wrote the script and played the heroine, a 16-year-old killer named S.
Tan's friends Jasmine Ang and Sophie Sadiq helped make the movie, which was directed by a mysterious teacher named George Cardona. After the shoot ended, Cardona vanished, along with all of the footage. The lost film didn't resurface until 2011, when it was returned to Tan, who by that time had become a novelist. Rather than finish the original movie, Tan made a documentary, also called Shirkers. It includes original footage from the 1992 film, but it also follows Tan on her quest to find out who Cardona really was.
I'm really good at keeping things in my life. I kept all my journals and my letters and videos, and I became a hoarder, actually, of my own teenagehood and my 20s and everything else, because when something that huge is stolen from your life, you tend to want to keep everything else. And as that my friends, because I was Jasmine, who accuses me of all kinds of things, including being a hoarder. And then one day, a few years ago, she just throws me this two big paper sacks of my letters to her, because she had kept every single one of them. And in fact, then I could, I had some of that material to use in the film. And I reread some of my letters and I realized became reacquainted with my teenage self, the self that I had repressed all these years, and remembered who the person was that decided to make Shirkers and who is obsessed with telling stories. And I realized I am still that, very much that same person. I just had to peel off this skin, this other layer I had, developed over the ensuing decades.
One of the things that is so fascinating about the movie is that the world that you were living in and growing up in was so repressive artistically, that Singapore was a country that was so restrictive you couldn't even chew gum.
You still can't.
You still can't.
Well, I guess you can chew gum if you bought it from somewhere else. Right. You just can't buy it there.
But that as an artist, what you were able to see and listen to in terms of film and music was so heavily censored that in some ways your artistic life was almost born in response to that, that you were rebelling against those things that you couldn't do by doing them yourself.
I just didn't think of it as rebellion. I was thinking of it as surviving and keeping sane and keeping myself interested in life. And that meant, getting stuff that was going to keep me interested in pursuing the arts or pursuing movies or music. And I guess when everything's banned around you and you have to kind of make your own fun and your own culture, you're more of an active participant in your own, intellectual growth. I guess when you take things for, when everything's available to you, like now, you kind of take it for granted. And so it was so difficult to look for movies. I spent my teenagehood reading magazines like American Film, American Cinematographer, and just wanting to see these films, things like Blue Velvet, of course, which would never show in Singapore. So, I spent my life, like when I was 14, writing to the Singapore Film Society and, urging them to show these films. And they had to go through the censors. So a lot of things were never shown. So what you have to do as a curious teenager is find extra ways. And so I had a cousin in Florida, was not interested in the movies, but was a great mole.
Great bootlegger.
a great unintentional mole for me, because she had parents and her parents had a Blockbuster card. And I said, I gave her a list of films that I was interested in seeing, including Blue Velvet and Angel Heart and things like that, and taught her how to hook two VCRs together and tape these movies for me. And so she sent me these parcels of contraband movies. And these were the things that kind of raised me, I guess.
There are two movies in Shirkers. There is the movie that you've just made and the movie that you tried to make so many years ago, 26 years ago now.
Oh, yeah, 26 years ago.
When you were thinking about revisiting It, the 1992 production, and reaching out to your friends and people who worked on it, did they take some persuading? Because this is, in some ways, a very difficult period about what happens and what becomes of this project.
Yes. I took persuading myself. It took me, 3 years before I could open the boxes.
This is the boxes of footage.
Of footage that was returned to me. But once I opened those boxes and saw what was in there, I knew that this would suck me into something that was unstoppable. It was going to be an obsession all over again. And it was. I think of it as that Stephen King story, It. I mean, we were children all bound by this kind of dark boogeyman, I guess, this thing that happened to us. And now we're grown-ups and, we had all repressed this and moved on. And then this thing reappears in our life, resurfaces 20 odd years later. And I was the person who was put in charge of kind of reanimating this dark force in our lives. So this was a very difficult process for me. And then I contacted Jasmine and Sophie, who were the two prime, I guess, friends, my co-conspirators, I guess, or at least people I led into this project in 1992. And then all the other characters as well, including the woman who sent me the boxes, who had been George's wife for a long time. And she took a lot of convincing to get involved in this, because in many ways, I think she was most affected by his shenanigans.
We're talking with Sandy Tan about her movie Shirkers. In many ways, this is a story about somebody who gives birth to a child, loses that child, and that child mysteriously returns to you many years later through a series of strange events. And the child in this case is a film that you made but was never finished because George thwarts it. I want to hear a little bit from a friend of his, Steven Tyler, about his theory about why George did what he did.
The pattern that emerges is that George would feel threatened by his protégés being successful. And the way that he dealt with that threat was to take action by absconding with physical manifestations of these people's dreams.
So much of this movie is about appropriation, that George is stealing other people's ideas. He's stealing their credits. He's stealing the footage. He is claiming for himself things that are not his. He is really preying on other people. Do you feel that making this movie is in some ways getting those things back from him? Not just physically, but almost kind of metaphysically reclaiming that part of your life that he took?
Yes, very much so. That was probably the most clarifying thing to me, making this film. I've just returned from the Singapore premiere of this film. You know, I reassembled a lot of the old friends who had, you know, given their free time and into the production in 1992. And a friend of mine who was closely involved said that, you know, seeing the movie after all these years and seeing himself in it, you know, he suddenly felt like he had been given a chunk of his life back. And even though this was a peripheral character who was kind of, you know, just a kind of an actor in the film, who was not as psychologically damaged, I guess, by this whole episode. And he felt like it was a chunk of his life that was taken away. So I think, you know, a lot of us felt that, including myself.
I was reading a review just before I came down to talk with you, and the reviewer said, imagine how Singapore film would have been changed by your film had it been finished and released. And it's heartbreaking to think about that something that could have been so influential and meaningful is stolen from you. When you revisit this whole story and think about the way you now see it, how has making the documentary about the film changed your perspective on what happened to you and what was taken away from you?
You know, I've been telling myself a lot of lies, comforting lies over the years that, you know, had this film been made, you know, nobody would have appreciated it. And my friends and I would have been so discouraged and, you know, laughed at. And we would be lawyers and doctors now. That's what I tell myself. But then, you know, listening to lots of people and having just shown this current Shirkers in Singapore a few days ago, they all felt like it was amazing and it would have maybe changed things. And it would have been a rallying call to other filmmakers to take risks, to do something that's fun and really different. And it would have encouraged a lot of, you know, kids to do the same. It's a really hard question to grapple with, because I could not allow myself to think that wonderful things would have happened. I don't know. I mean, a lot of people think it would have made a big difference. Sophie, for example, she's a film scholar and thinks that, you know, this is the missing link in Singapore film history. This would have been, you know, this would have caused everything to be different. And yeah, I you know, that could have happened. But it would really mess up my life to think so. I do feel like I've regained something from this. I have regained basically my voice, my confidence in storytelling, my passion in, you know, confronting this demon from a long time ago and kind of making sense of this whole episode and reclaiming and refilling this black hole in our lives. It's a coming of age story to me, like very, very late coming of age story. But I feel like I have finally grown up.
Sandy, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. This was really great fun.
Shirkers is out on Netflix this Friday. Coming up, why artist Kip Fulbeck spent years documenting people like him who identify as part Asian but 100% Hapa.
KPCC podcast supporters include UCLA Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Josh Fox with his new work, The Truth Has Changed. From the director of Gasland comes a live performance tracing the arc of American politics from 9/11 to Trump. From his experiences as an eyewitness to 9/11, the BP oil spill, Bernie Sanders campaign, and Standing Rock, Fox delivers an insightful account of how we got to where we are today. October 27th at Brood Playhouse. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Identity is at the center of Kip Fulbeck's long-term photography endeavor, known as the Hapa Project. It's included a book, exhibits, and portraits that he's taken of hundreds of people from all over the country. Now, what began 17 years ago is about to reach its conclusion, or at least a conclusion, for Fulbeck. His final exhibit, titled Hapa.me, is in its last days at the Japanese American National Museum in downtown L.A., and he invites museum goers to take their own photos. And that's where Frame contributor Quincy Surasmith took a tour with the artist and even participated himself.
In 2001, artist Kip Fulbeck started taking photos of people who, like him, identified as Hapa, or mixed race. The term, Hapa, has its roots in the Hawaiian language to mean mixed or part, including in the context of referring to those with mixed Native Hawaiian heritage. He'd take their portraits and ask them simply, "What are you?" The question was meant to elicit a sort of statement of identity, or at least of how they see themselves in the world.
I did about 1,200 people, early 2000s, and I made a book with Chronicle Books called Part Asian 100% Hapa, and the Japanese American National Museum held the first show in 2006, and that was like the beginning of everything.
In his current exhibition, Hapa.me, Fulbeck has returned to the original participants with updated portraits and statements.
So here we are in the exhibit. So these are, there are 23 pairs, well, 46 images based on, you know, it's my DNA joke. Everyone here is between about 15 years apart. Some are 17, some are 13, but roughly average about 15 years apart. This woman, Christy Turner here, her first one when she was in her 20s, the statement says, "What am I? Shouldn't you be asking my name first?" And it's kind of this, like, response, like, what am I, the way that a female would, like, you know, typical guy asking you and knowing you, he'll smile, these kind of things. And a second one, 15 years later, it says, "Hey, I'm Christine, nice to meet you too." And it's just a different kind of maturing. It's, she's not defensive, she's learned how to pick her battles, and I think it's 21 to 36. It's a very definitive maturing. It's very obvious in her picture and her statement. So this gentleman I photographed in inland San Diego, he goes by Ichiban. The first picture, he's got a very heavy gaze. He's got a handlebar mustache and a crew cut, and he looks like he's about to fight you. And the second one, he's got hair down. He looks like a Hapa Jesus. He's got a long hair down past his shoulders, a big beard, and a really open, welcoming gaze. The project isn't even about race. The project is about identity. And it just uses race as a starting point to talk about it. When I grew up, 1970, LA County, my cousin told me, "You're Hapa." I'm like, "What?" Because she went to Monterey High. And, you know, there's some people from Hawaii there, and they told her. And so I'm like, "Oh, okay." And so I grew up thinking it's, "Oh, that must mean you're Chinese, English, Irish." And then later I read other people, and they're like, "Oh, I'm Hapa." I'm like, "Oh." And then I lived in Hawaii. I'm like, and it's like a completely different definition there. I wanted to find other people around and see, like, who was really involved and invested in identifying that way. And the other one is I want to show that we are nothing alike. That there is, I mean, people always say, like, "Oh, you finally found your tribe." No, we have nothing in common besides we couldn't fill out a form correctly because it says pick one box. Okay, so everyone's shot the same way. Collarbone up, looking straight at the camera, no expression, no jewelry, no glasses, no heavy makeup, because I wanted it as neutral as possible. And really importantly, I wanted to make sure they were okay with it. Writing a statement on a blank piece of paper, you know, who you are, that's a big question. And some people are like, they come in with these, you know, 10 statements already written. And I realized that, you know, it's really profound. Sometimes we've never been asked. That's all I'm asking people to do is be vulnerable, be yourself.
Right here on the bottom of this piece of paper under the Polaroid, mm-hmm. you're going to be writing down the answer to the question, who or what are you?
Okay.
And you don't even really have to write anything. If you want, you can even draw a picture.
The interactive portion, I contacted Fuji and they were super stoked about doing this. They have the technology called the Instax. Instax is instant film made by Fuji. And so I went there, I said, "Hey, you know, this is a great camera. Can we use this to photograph people? Because there's a difference between me shooting you digitally and printing it versus me shooting you and you hold it in your hand, you watch the chemistry work."
On three. 1, 2, 3. Yes. This is printing and...
Oh, yeah, printing.
Oh, yeah, you're fine.
What the heck? It's pretty cool.
Oh, is that...
So I'm Jenny, and I actually live in Venice, California.
And I'm Kenji, and I live in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
So we took a picture together and then basically described what are you, or basically, like, who are you, what's your identity in the blank space beneath.
The "what are you, who are you" question is a question that mixed people get often, so I think it's kind of playing off of the common question.
We took a really long time to figure it out and decided to go really corny. So we put like our general ethnic backgrounds next to the picture. And then we said mixed babies that met in Minnesota, 100% best friends. And then he wrote 100% gross underneath that. So...
I've had people tell me, like, why'd you include some of these people that are Asian? That's not Hapa. I'm like, you don't get to tell them who they are. I think showing that diversity of, like, the, you know, 7+ million Hapas in the U.S., showing that diversity was really important to me. I always feel like identity is a completely personal process. You're right to call yourself what you want to call yourself. No one gets to tell you who you are. And so basically I said, if you want to fall under this rubric of what you think Hapa is, then be part of the project.
I took him up on that, especially since I'm mixed ethnicity Thai and Chinese myself. And I submitted my own statement, that we are 100% everything we are, that we get to tell our own story. Let's tell more. For The Frame, I'm Quincy Surasmith.
The Hapa.me exhibit is at the Japanese American National Museum in LA through October 28. And that is it for today. Remember, you can get The Frame as a podcast and listen at your convenience. And you'll also find web versions of many of our stories at laist.com. That's laist.com. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.